Hello and welcome to Catholic Cancer's Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and today we get to know one of the most dynamic pro-life leaders in America and get her take on where the movement for the right to life is at this moment. Kristen Hawkins is the president of Students for Life of America. Since launching Students for Life of America as a full-time operation, Kristen has helped more than triple the number of campus pro-life groups in the United States from about 181 to well over 1,000, maybe more than 1,030 in all 50 states. She's also she grew the SFLA National Conference from 450 attendees just a decade ago to more than 2,000 in 2015. That's probably the largest regular pro-life conference in the United States. Kristen Hawkins, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So first I want to ask you about the conference. This conference that you have, you're drawing college students, high school students. Who's coming to the conference?
Our conference is majority college and high school students.
And so you're getting 2,000 college and high school students to travel somewhere, and how much? It's over several days?
It's we had about 2,400 students this year, and that is on two coasts, and so they do travel. It's a one-day conference, and we, to eliminate some of the costs, we try to put our conference the day after the Walk for Life in San Francisco and the day after the March for Life in Washington, D.C.
Ah, brilliant. Now, where are young people today? I remember what it was like in the 70s and 80s, but say I'm talking to a high school student or a college student today. What am I likely to be experienced as far as their understanding of the life issues and their views about the life issues?
Well, actually, I was just reading a New York Times op-ed this morning about abortion and feminism, and one of the columnists from the New York Times acknowledged something that we've been saying for years, is that this generation doesn't fall lockstep with the progressives or the left in America on abortion. They're actually pro-life. They see abortion differently than their parents did. Now, it doesn't mean they have all the facts. It doesn't mean they have the best arguments if they've thought about the philosophical underpinnings of having a Christian worldview. But they acknowledge that there's something wrong with abortion. They know that there's something bad with abortion. And that's really, I mean, that's a great starting point for us to be in. And it's a great conversation, way to really start that conversation when we're on college campuses, because they already acknowledge that there's something icky there. And we're just simply there equipping them and mobilizing them and really encouraging them to take that courageous stance.
So I would suggest that we've had decades and decades now of propaganda about this, even from news organizations that otherwise they shouldn't be engaging in propaganda, but they do. But so what's breaking through that propaganda and allowing young people to see, no, there's a lie here, or there's something not right here?
I think that science really just breaks through a lot of that. They've seen their brothers and sisters via ultrasound. The antiquated argument that it's just a blob of tissue, that a child doesn't become a child to, suddenly this magical moment at birth, just really doesn't hold water. I think you'll also see the personal testimonies that many of us have had friends who've had abortion. We've had family members who had an abortion, and the abortion never solved the problem. It only exacerbated the problem. And I think that's something that you can see in Hollywood movies and scripts that are coming out from movies that, from most people would say these are very secular movies. There's cursing and, sexual references, but yet there's still an underlying pro-life message there.
So it's getting through. There are cracks, in other words, in the facade of the whole idea that this is just a rights issue for women.
That's exactly right. And, this is something how when we're on campuses and we're talking with and how many of our students see the issue, they don't see it necessarily as a faith issue. They see it as a human rights issue. And that they know that this is just wrong. That's a human being within his or her mother, and that's wrong to choose violence. And that's something, you know, it's been really popular lately. The feminist movements have been talking about violence, and you can't deny, no matter if you're pro-abortion or if you're pro-life, you can't deny that what happens during abortion is not violence. It's truly a violent act, and there's just, if you're anti-violence, if you're against violence, you know, in any regard, you cannot be for abortion.
It is striking that that insight that young people have then comes at a time when we hear that they're less religious than ever. So as you said, it's not like there's a great faith awakening where people, you know, are saying, oh, you know, what's God's will on this? They're looking at the basic facts. Somehow that is getting through despite what I think is, as I said, propaganda, a massive kind of wall of denial about this in our media.
And
nonetheless, it gets through.
That's right. And this is something that, you know, I think when I speak to adult audiences and we talk about faith and, you know, how do we talk about faith to this generation, I think it's a really, you know, the pro-life issue is a really great issue. It's a really great way to start having that discussion. You know, our model at SFLA is belong, believe, behave, which is a very basic evangelization model, because we know that, you know, people aren't going to really listen to you until they like you, until they have a relationship with you. And so that's why, you know, starting pro-life groups, student pro-life groups on campuses is so important, that we just don't go to a campus, do an event, and leave, because we can change the hearts and minds, but it's through those relationships. And that's the same way when we talk about, you know, we have had so many stories of students who've, you know, fallen away from their faith. It's a typical story that you would assume on a college campus, you know, a student who went to Catholic school or went to a private Christian school, you know, went to college, was challenged on their faith, didn't have the right answers at hand, then started, you know, questioning their faith, have fallen away, stopped attending mass, stopped attending a church service. But then when they get involved in the pro-life movement, they get involved because of that Christian worldview, because they realize that all human beings have the right to life. And they don't see it as a faith step. They see it as a human rights thing. That's why they want it, they care. But really it does point back to that Christian worldview that they have. But then they get into that pro-life group, and suddenly they're surrounded by other Christians and people who are willing to ask them questions and challenge them and also support them. And we've made a lot of Catholics students for life, and a lot of Christians, and brought a lot of people back to their faith, and it hasn't been by design. It's through that relationship that you have once you join those students for life groups.
But now you started very young. As a matter of fact, something I'm very interested in is West Virginia Teens for Life, where you were president in high school of West Virginia Teens for Life. So it wasn't for you this kind of gradual thing. Somehow this was very, very early on for you.
Sure, it sure was. Yeah, I was asked when I was 15 to spend a summer to volunteer at a pregnancy help center. A woman at my church had been serving as a part-time accountant there, and I think she was looking for some free labor. And she said, you know, I heard you're looking for some volunteer opportunities. Would you like to come and be my summer intern? And that's really the first time I had any exposure to what the pregnancy center movement was. You know, I kind of just thought, yeah, pro-woman, we're helping out women. Wasn't even really thinking that much about abortion. But then when I walked into that center, the women there were so excited to have me because I was the same age or even a little older than a lot of the younger women who were coming in for pregnancy tests, for counseling, for material services. And so I just had an incredible summer there. I became a counselor with the pregnancy center, a heartbeat center. You know, of course, I did the usual teen intern stuff of cleaning out the supply room and dusting off the old PC and teaching everyone how to make a newsletter with clip art. But, you know, it was just an incredible life-changing summer. I had gone in thinking that I wanted to become an aeronautical engineer, and I left thinking this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. And so that's when I went back to my high school, and I started a Teens for Life group, became involved with the Right to Life affiliate in the state, and I became the president of the state Teen Right to Life group, and we would go on lobbying trips, and I would speak across the state. But really, you know, it was that summer at the Pregnancy Center that really just activated me, that, you know, I belonged, I believed, and then I became to behave. And then, you know, just nonstop since then.
And also, tell us about when you go off to college then. How does this develop when you're off in college?
Sure. Well, I knew when I went to college I wanted to start a Students for Life group as well. I didn't, you know, when I was in high school, and even when I was in high school, I had gone to some Right to Life conferences, but I, you know, there were like five younger people there with me. It didn't really seem like this was something that young people were a part of, that we were still the extreme minority at a pro-life conference. So I didn't ever think to go to Google and, you know, look for pro-life students or look for other friends or ideas. So I started a Students for Life group in my college. And at the time I decided, you know, I want to be a lawyer. I want to overturn Roe versus Wade. And that soon changed once I met some of the other pre-law majors and decided I don't want to hang out with these people. I think I want to become an activist. But that's a really hard job to convince your parents that you want to go to college for, is to become a full-time pro-life activist. So I spent my college years studying political science and history, and I thought, well, I'll become a political, you know, I'll become a professor of politics. I'll go through, you know, the whole gamut of school, and then one day I'll be able to do what I want and serve in the pro-life movement. Little did I know the plans that God had made for me.
Well, they're extraordinary plans because do you think you just have some natural, you're an organizer and a builder of these kinds of things? Because what you've done at Students for Life has gained a good deal of attention because it just seems to be going from success to success or from growth to growth. Is this a natural thing in you?
I mean, if you'd ask my friends, I'm always been the bossy person. So I think that's probably how most people would describe it, especially for a woman. It's bossiness. But yes, and I like to build. I like to grow things. I find challenge in that, and so that's when I first met the young people that were trying to launch Students for Life full time. I was actually in Washington. I was working for President Bush's administration. I had kind of a very boring but cushy government job, and you know, they said, you know, look, we want to do what you did in high school and colleges, but we want to do this across the country. And I thought, you know, this is just an incredible opportunity for other people who were like me, because I could have been served. I could have been so much more effective when I was in high school and college had I known other people like me, had I been able to study leadership skills, you know, get best practices for public relations and fundraising and things like that. So that just, I thought of myself, you know, as a student, how I would have really liked it. But it was just an incredible challenge of, you know, let's go out and find other people who can do this. It's a very proactive approach. It's not a reactive approach. You know, the goal was, let's go to campuses and let's start groups. Let's not wait for students to find out about us. We're going to go find them. And that excites me. That's what gets me going every day, is how can we find more and more students to join this movement, more and more young people who can become leaders on their campuses and also their communities. Because we know just from the history of social movement organizing, we have to have young people on our side. Cultural change starts with young people. Hollywood, you know, everyone looks to young people for what's cool, what's hip, what's trending. And if we can make pro-life the majority opinion, we're going to change everything. And, you know, politics is downstream from culture. You know, we're going to change everything by simply making these small changes in the high schools and colleges across our country.
And one of the things that you do is, well, your Students for Life is very professional about this, but maybe tell us about the field program, because you're not just going into campuses and throwing it like spaghetti against the wall. You're doing much more. You're following the progress. And how is that done?
Sure. Well, we modeled our organization off of a political campaign. I had worked for President Bush's 2004 reelection campaign. And what I loved about that was we had field staff members, field agents, where we had sent them out across the states, and they would recruit volunteers to make phone calls and go door to door. And that's really what we modeled Students for Life after, of we're not going to just be online. We're not just going to have a really great website, encourage people to come to us. We're going to actually go onto campuses. I'm a big believer in, you know, running nonprofits like businesses, of having metrics, of having outcome-based performance goals. So for us, it was, let's go and let's, you know, measure. How many campuses can we get to? How many students can we talk to? How many pro-life Students for Life groups can we start? And then how many activities are those Students for Life groups are having? So right now, today, we have about 35 team members across the country. More than half are on campuses every single day. And they have a series of goals of starting new Students for Life groups, improving the quality of our existing groups, meaning, you know, increasing the number of members, having those groups do more meaningful, tangible events on campuses, training students in leadership and other pro-life activism skills, and really just reaching their campuses for this issue.
And how are you paying for all that? That sounds extremely expensive.
Yeah, welcome to my life. No, we are a nonprofit, so it's a lot of phone calls and letters and emails and visits because we're fundraising for this every day, and that's one of my chief roles within the organization. Is not only am I the spokesperson and the strategist and the chief bossy person, but I'm also the one finding investors who care about, you know, changing and transforming our culture, starting with where it's made, and that's young people.
And why did you start Med Students for Life and Law Students for Life as kind of subgroups of Students for Life?
Well, I mean, a lot of times we have alumni who they want to go to law school and they want to go to med school, and we want to have a way to get them involved, keep them involved in this movement. We don't want to lose them, for sure, but we also know, you know, especially with medical schools, there's a whole generation of physicians that are coming out of our medical schools that literally do not know when life begins or when it ends. I mean, I've had like fourth-year med students ask me, well, when does life actually end? We're not sure. And these are the students that they're going to be making life-impacting decisions every single day.
And how are those groups growing? Are those also having the kind of success you're having with the more general groups?
Those groups are growing at a smaller pace, simply because the majority of what we do is on the high school and college campuses, and apparently people don't really get too excited about supporting future doctors and lawyers.
Really?
Yeah, you know, I think people just think, oh, doctors, they don't need my money. But yeah, we've got about 50 active Med Students for Life groups. I think we've got about 20 wow. Law Students for Life groups. I think this is something that's really important, because there's a full-time organization called Med Students for Choice. Their entire mission is to impact future medical professionals. We're totally beating the other side when it comes to college and high school campuses. I mean, Planned Parenthood usually boosts about having, you know, they say, oh, you know, we have 200 pro-life, what they call them now, they copied us. So we're pro-life generation. So they're Planned Parenthood generation. So they say that they have 200 Planned Parenthood generation clubs, and, you know, we're well over 1,000. But when it comes to med schools, we're losing that battle right now. Med Students for Choice has over 100, I think, chapters, and we're around 50. And they're actually hosting, you know, weekend training seminars to students of how to perform abortions on papayas. And there's a Ryan Fellowship, which seeks to have full-time staff members in medical schools across the country that are also abortionists. to go in, and because what they realize is they can't, you know, young people don't like abortion, and it's really hard to convince a med school student to actually commit them. And so they're actually very active in trying to recruit the future of the abortion industry.
It seems like a temptation business, well, to try to attract people to do something that is,
for sure,
is obviously an unattractive. I mean, the doctor, I suppose, depending on the stage of development of the child, the doctor has to know what's going on.
That's exactly right. And, you know, they use different ways to appeal to these students, talking about, you know, the additional money they can make from it to pay off their medical school bills faster, because, you know, a med student graduates with, what, $250,000 debt average. They've actually have been starting doing seminars within the med schools of talking about, you know, if you're really pro-choice, you have to be willing to commit abortions. And they challenge the students. They, you know, they say, look, you're going to be a hypocrite. If you're pro-choice but you're not willing yourself to commit the abortion, then you're a hypocrite. And that speaks to students. And I was at an event at George Washington Med School. We had one of my friends there. He was speaking. He was a former abortionist. He was talking about his former abortion career, why he changed his mind. And we had this med student who walked in, and we knew she was very – we could tell she was very hostile to what he was saying. And she raised her hand at the end and said that, you know, she was pro-choice, and that she realized that if she was going to be an OBGYN, say she was pro-life, that she couldn't be a hypocrite, that she would have to commit abortions. And so she actually had been interning at the Planned Parenthood down the street, and she talked about how, you know, during her first abortion that she witnessed, that she said, you know, I'm not going to lie, I had a very emotional, emotional reaction to, you know, trying to put together the pieces of the fetus. But, you know, I just realized that this is what I have to do, that if I'm going to be pro-choice, this is what I have to do. And it was so, I mean, she was being so real with her comments, and she was obviously still in disagreement with us. But I thought it just showed how they make future abortionists, that this is the messaging, this is the rhetoric to them of, yes, you might feel bad about what you see after the abortion, but really your loyalty lies to us and to our movement. And so, you know, to not do those abortions, to say you don't want to be a part of that, is questioning, you know, your whole worldview, this feminism worldview.
It's a brutal business. Wow. It takes a – it's a desensitizing process, you're saying. You're
right.
Saying, well, we'll use the kind of natural human desire to belong and to be
right.
affirmed and all that, to essentially desensitize us to what we're doing, even though we can see it with our own eyes what we're doing.
That's exactly right.
Well, what about Pregnant on Campus? What's that about? That's part of your – that's part of Students for Life. Pregnant on Campus means what?
Pregnant on Campus is something we launched a few years ago, and really the goal was to help better equip our students on campuses to go beyond the diaper drives and maybe the baby showers and really create substantive change on their college campuses, something that is a legacy that they leave behind. Because we know, we just know, you know, you can look at statistics if you've ever been out from an abortion facility and prayed on abortion day, you know that no woman wants to have an abortion, that she winds up at the abortion facility when she feels like she's out of choices, that she's out of options. No one is ever saying, oh, I'm so excited to go exercise my freedom of choice today.
No.
You know, there's a reason why we don't talk about abortion and women don't talk about their abortions, because even though women might have them, they know it in their heart, in their minds, that there's something wrong with that abortion. And so we started with that understanding of, okay, no woman wants to have an abortion. However, if she's pregnant and she's on a college campus, a lot of times there's nothing for her. Or what is for her, she doesn't know about. You know, and so she's going to be faced with, I either drop out of school and get a job or I have my child. And the goal we had was, let's make it so she doesn't have to make that choice. Let's work with our campus administrations to make sure we have flexible class schedules, that, you know, maybe she doesn't lose her housing scholarship. And really what this, we launched it after basically two situations. We had at Christian universities. One was Catholic, one was Protestant. The Protestant, I think, was Baptist. And both situations were that, you know, girls on these campuses were, you know, they're still having sex. They're still getting pregnant. But yet, unlike a state school, it's even more difficult on a private school campus, and even especially if it's a Christian campus, because there's behavior contracts that you have to sign sometimes going into these schools, commitment that you're making to yourself and to your parents and to your school. And when that commitment has been broken and you're pregnant, there's not really a lot of options available to you. The school will say you can't stay in their dorms because it's an insurance liability, which is kind of crazy, you know, especially when your first, second trimesters are ongoing. But there's no one there to help you. And so really our idea was, let's come alongside our student groups and let's get them working with their administrations to create some substantial change.
So I'm sorry, but I'm stuck on this idea of a Christian college where a young woman would be unwelcome because she's pregnant, but I there's no consequence for the young man. I mean, one would assume that there's a man involved here somewhere. So, wow, that's really something. So when you feel as if you can kind of create a maybe an agitation or a movement on a campus to say, let's take care of women who are pregnant, who are part of this campus community, then that does it do multiple things? I mean, it will actually help direct resources towards those young women, and it will also maybe open the eyes of the campus to that this is a reality, that we don't just want to solve this and by, you know, abortion as solution, so to speak, that we want to care for the members of our campus community here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, we always talk a lot about leaving signs of hope, that a lot of times we're never going to meet a girl who's facing unplanned pregnancy on campus. You know, it's very rare a girl will come up to, you know, our student life table while we're tabling to tell us that she needs help. We have seconds. We literally have seconds now because of Google, because of how advanced the abortion industry is on marketing and messaging to young women in crisis, that we have seconds before she goes to Google and types in the word abortion. So we want to leave signs of hope on that campus, you know, talking about the lactation rooms and the diaper decks and the bathrooms, doing, you know, panels and having discussions and constantly talking about the resources that are available on that campus. So the goal is, you know, when she finds herself pregnant, when she's in that crisis moment, she thinks to herself, maybe this is possible. That her first reaction isn't, I can't do this. I can't be a student and be a mother.
Well, so now where do you think we are in the wider picture? Like, if you had to say, what is this moment we're living in? I mean, it's a very odd and divided political moment. I mean, one would almost say it feels sometimes dangerously divided, and our politics feels vindictive. Our culture seems to be really one of constant accusation. But if you kind of take a deep breath and say, where are we then in this long American struggle to see the child as a child, as a human being, to at least acknowledge the presence of the child, and then to extend human rights to that child? Where are we at this moment from your vantage point?
I think, you know, we've made significant progress in the past 40 plus years. I think we're at a point where, because of technology, because of science, the child does have value. The child does have worth. You know, the more these children are born premature, the more that there's surgeries being performed on children in utero who have spina bifida. This is huge for us because it shows to our culture that these children have value. So I think we're in a much better spot than we were, I would say, in the 90s, when the abortion support was at its highest, where the abortion industry was at its highest in terms of abortions they were committing every year. We're definitely in a much better spot than we were in the 1990s. But I think the challenge for us today moving forward is kind of the cognitive dissonance that we see. on campuses where, you know, yes, we agree with you. You know, we debuted a project last year at UCLA, and it was our When Did Human Rights Display Begin? So When Did Human Rights Begin? And we had pictures of children in utero at different stages of development, descriptions of the biological markers of what's happening in utero at that moment. A lot of the pictures were of my children before the ultrasounds I had taken. And, you know, we had 95% of the students at UCLA vote with us that that human rights began at conception. And we were like, wow, this is, you know, this is great. You know, thank you so much for telling us this. And, we agree with you. You know, let us ask you a question. How do you feel about abortion? And then that's when the conversation stopped or it would dramatically change. Well, that's different. That's different. And we said, well, can you explain to us? You know, a lot of things we do is very Socratic. We're asking students questions because we want them to have to think about this issue in a way that they've never been thought about before, moving beyond just that rhetoric that they're hearing. And, it was interesting because a lot of students, they didn't really know how to answer the question. We would say, okay, well, you know, are you saying that a person's wantedness determines their value? So, you know, what about a 2-year-old child? We would run different scenarios through the conversation. And one student, though, he kind of summed it up perfectly for us because he said, you just have to be okay living in a paradox. And I thought that was something that was really different from Generation X and previous generations where people would want to be philosophically consistent, that they wouldn't want to be in a paradoxical situation. Where the student was, he was okay with saying that. He was okay with saying, yes, the child has human rights, but with abortion, it's okay to violate that child's human rights. And yes, I know that that's probably, scientifically, that's not right to say, but I don't really care. And I'm okay living in a paradox, basically being a hypocrite. Mm. And I thought that was something that was really, the conversations I've had with different apologists since then is how do you really bridge that when you get to a point where people will say, yeah, I know it's a child, I know it's a human being, I know that human being has rights, but I don't really care if it's killed or not.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
All I would say, sometimes students will say that just because they've known they've backed themselves into a corner, and we just repeat back what they say, and hopefully they hear how awful what they've just said is. And we know some of them, most human beings never like to admit they're wrong. Yeah. So that when they go back to their dorm room or the next time the conversation comes up, their attitude might have been completely changed. But then I think there's some people that they're okay with that.
It seems then when we reach that point, because I do think there is that element to this whole, an irrational element. And when we are at an irrational level with the human being, it seems that we're into an area of spiritual struggle.
Yeah.
And I wonder, as a Catholic myself, I would say, well, we have fasting, we have praying, we have tools to engage this spiritual level. I mean, when someone can blankly say, yes, I know that's a human being, but its life doesn't matter, that there's a spiritual deficit there that needs healing or help or rescue or resuscitation or whatever. I don't, and that could be a human spirit. It could just be the kind of egoism of the human spirit, or it could be a demonic spirit. So how do you come down on that idea that at some point there's a spiritual battle as well in these issues?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. And I think it's very hard because if without a Christian worldview, there is no moral grounding in a lot of these discussions. And you can get, I was actually asked by Notre Dame Students for Life, their Right to Life group a couple years ago to give a apologetics defense of life, of the pro-life position, but I wasn't allowed to go religious on it.
Uh-huh.
And so I went through everything I could, and then I finally got to the end, and I said, okay, here is the metaphysical question that I'm not going to answer because we're not going to go religious, but this is where we end up, of what gives you value. And who determines your value? And that's the metaphysical question. That's the question where your faith comes into that. And so I think when we have these discussions on campuses, one of the things that we really try to do, especially with young men like that, of we want to have a positive conversation with them. We want it to be a respectful conversation. And we always want to encourage them to keep coming back, because that conversation is going to replay in his or her mind multiple times after you've had it. And we want to be the people that start that belong in that evangelization model. We want to start to have that relationship with them, where we can have that those harder discussions out of respect, but that are something that they feel comfortable talking to us about. So a lot of times we always invite, you know, pro-choice students, like, hey, you know, you can come to our Students for Life meeting. There's nothing secretive that happens at a Students for Life club meeting. Come and check us out, you know. Come and see if this is a place where you want to fit into or you want to explore and learn more about, because it is. It becomes these faith questions. And for a lot of the students, you know, especially the ones that we deal with on campuses, I had this one conversation with this atheist last winter on a campus, and he was raised Catholic, he was raised pro-life, and now he was, you know, arguing for utilitarian and concepts, and I got him, you know, to admit that he felt like the life of the frog was the same value as the life of the person, and because I had to keep drilling down to, like, what he believed. But it was a conversation that I hope that left him with an impression of who we are, who we are as Christians, who we are as human beings, that this is an okay group, and this is a group that I might have questions about my faith. I might have these questions that are going on, but there's people I can talk to. They're not going to judge me for it. They're not going to, because I think that's what we talk about, you know, rhetoric. I mean, because that's what the other side tries so hard to do, of saying this is who pro-lifers are, this is how they will behave, and so it's very scary to a lot of people.
And yeah, right. So it's being approachable, being an actual, well, just being a human, where you're okay. You're not just a caricature. That actually is part of helping to share the pro-life message.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And what about you in your own, like, does your spiritual life, where has it been developed by this? Were you born with a strong Catholic faith, or what's your journey been like?
Yeah, no, I wasn't. I converted to Catholicism 2.5 years ago, so I came home to the church then. I was raised in a non-denominational Christian home, very strong, you know, faith background. You know, church was the center of our, you know, social life. Church on Sundays, Sunday night, sometimes on Wednesdays, and then once a month there was probably something going on church on Saturday night as well. And so, you know, I was very lucky, and I look back at that and I thought that's so lucky that I had this amazing church family, that my extended family all went to the same church. So I've never really struggled, and I've never had, you know, a great, you know, question of faith in my life. It's just something that I've always believed, and it's never, even, you know, with everything that we've done with Students for Life and the challenges we've had with, I have two children, two of my four children have cystic fibrosis, which is a, you know, a life-threatening disease that's progressive. I've never really had that crisis, and I've been very lucky in that sense. But yeah, my faith was developed, you know, joining the pro-life movement. I remember that first summer working at the Crisis Pregnancy Center. And that's where I would say I kind of met my first faithful Catholic. And so, like, you know, I grew up in West Virginia, and, you know, some of the things they say about West Virginia are sometimes true. But, you know, there were certain impressions that I had of who Catholics were and what Catholics believed. And that was really the first time I befriended Catholics and got to know a little bit about the faith. And it wasn't pushed on me in any way, but just really becoming friends with Catholics and realizing, wow, these people really, they know their Bible. They know their faith.
What kind of Catholics were these? I haven't. I'm only teasing. I'm sorry.
They were Franciscan University Catholics.
Oh, okay.
So.
Well, they do know their faith then.
Yeah. No, but then when I got involved in, you know, to D.C. and we launched Students for Life, well, the only people who would come and work for me were Catholic. So I think it was a lot of them were crazy Franciscan kids who were like, yeah, we're going to take a chance and we're going to work for this organization that, you know, their model is completely unfounded and they're not real sure what they're doing yet. And so it was Catholics. So for a long time, it was me and a bunch of Catholics working for Students for Life. And so that's, you know, and then all of my friends, you know, all of the friends, the people that I rely on for support, you know, well, most of them were Catholic. So that's where I was able to really start, you know, learning more about the faith, and asking questions and feeling comfortable to ask questions, I guess. When we moved to Minnesota, we moved here to Minnesota almost 3 years ago to be closer to my son and daughter's medical team. We found the perfect house right across from a parish. And so I said, you know, maybe this is just God telling me I need to get my butt into the Catholic Church. So that's when I started RCIA, and I was welcomed to the church that Easter.
Wow, that's a beautiful story. And I wonder what you make of the theory, though, that like some people you hear this kind of theory that all of the kind of new paganism and the new morality that's posing such enormous challenges for Christianity actually is a kind of ecumenical force in a way. It has a kind of ecumenical power in that it forces us Christians to be closer to one another and to stop having so much suspicion of one another because we need one another so much. Is that your experience?
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. You know, I spend a lot of time in New York City, and it's interesting. I was at an event in New York City, and one of the speakers stood up and was like, look, you know, in New York, we're so outnumbered. We are not going to argue about, you know, differences between Catholicism and Protestants. He's like, heck, if you just believe in the Bible, you're on our team. And I think this gentleman's wife was Jewish. And so he's like, we just need the Old Testament and New Testament Bible believers together. And it was interesting because it is. When you're under attack like that, it helps kind of eliminate what are the petty disagreements. And some of them are big disagreements that we have. But there's things that we could totally agree on and move forward together. And really, I'm a big advocate for let's do all that we can to work with our Protestant brothers and sisters, because there's just so much, so many misconceptions out there about the Catholic faith. And it's really crazy. Like you think in 2017, like there wouldn't be so much, but there really is. And a lot of it is just, you know, stuff that, you know, when you were as a child born and, you know, raised in a Protestant family, things that you're told and that's ingrained into you. And really, it takes someone who's, like, seeking to look into it and to find more information about what is it that Catholics really believe. Are they worshiping Mary? Why are they worshiping idols? It takes someone to actually, like, ask that question. Is that really true? I'm going to go to Google. I spent a lot of time on Catholic Answers website when I was in the process of converting. Heck, I think I got most of your all's library from a couple of our supporters who found out I was an RCIA and then started inundating me with books.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah, so here we are, and it does seem to have this kind of ecumenical force in a way. It's that is to realize – like as you said, there some of these differences between us are a big deal, but that doesn't mean we haven't been petty about them with one another. Like you can, there are ways to have big disagreements that are big-hearted, and there are ways to have big disagreements that are petty. And it does seem like a lot of the pettiness is getting kind of melted away in the furnace of a cultural emergency. Really,
for sure. So I would agree with that. I mean, look at now I'm looking at Pastor Rick Warren. I'm looking at his picture on my wall.
Yeah.
It's been amazing. Like I've seen him at like four big Catholic events this year.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And when you see more and more of that. So now tell me the next steps. If I said to you, you're in charge of the entire pro-life movement in the coming decades, what would you say? Here's the things that are going to make that a success.
Well, no pressure or anything, Si.
Well, if I got to pick someone, it's going to be you.
Well, I mean, I think when we look at, you know, what do we need to do in the next few years specifically in the movement, you know, we've got to continue on in the cultural change. We've got to strengthen our resources with working with students and college students. And we even launched this year a middle school program. Something that I've been working with different pregnancy centers on is absence education, because, you know, there's government-funded absence education going on in these public schools, and there's opportunities for pregnancy centers to take a part of that and take advantage of that. And we need to build that relationship before Planned Parenthood does. And that's how Planned Parenthood really gets their hooks into our students. So we've got to do a better job of that. It needs to be the pro-life movement there educating students about sex and talking about sex at the very, very beginning. I think there's you know, things that we've got to be doing better in our communities. We've got to be active in our communities, uniting the different pro-life forces. You know, I was talking to somebody about California the other day, and, you know, everyone writes off California. We've got to impact the state of California, mm-hmm. because this is a state that literally drives our culture with Hollywood right there. This is a state that has the largest amount of abortions that are occurring. California would be like, what, the world's fifth largest country just in, with the economy. But so much awful, you know, stuff is coming out of Sacramento. And so what can we do in, you know, California? And really my answer was, we just need to be there. We need to stop giving up. And we need to have full-time people in every city in California and across the country who work with the pregnancy centers, who work with the Right to Life groups, who work with other organizations that may not be, you know, quote, pro-life, but help support women and children. And we need to be marketing what we do better. That's one of the things that, you know, I focus a lot of time in Students for Life on, is about our narrative and what's the narrative that we're shaping this pro-life generation, that we want to show this generation that it's cool to be pro-life, and actually the majority of people are pro-life, because that's how we know people want to join winning causes. But at the same time, we also know this huge problem of, we have more pregnancy centers than abortion facilities in our country. We have 13,000 federally qualified health centers and rural health centers across the country that we already pay with our taxpayer dollars, yet we're arguing about Planned Parenthood that only operates 600 centers. These federally qualified health centers serve 24 million. Planned Parenthood serves barely 2 million a year. This is something, but we're just not good marketers of talking about what are all the resources available at the community for her, so she doesn't feel like she has to turn to Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry. So if I were running the pro-life movement in this magical world, I would be spending a lot of time on marketing and being the bigger voice in the room, because we're up against a lot. I mean, Planned Parenthood is a $1 billion organization, and that, I mean, they're the Goliath of the abortion industry for sure. But they're really leading the charge when it comes to PR, whether it's in Washington or whether it is in San Diego and the local abortion facility there. And we have to be able to take them to task. And we have more people than they do. We have more centers than they do. We offer way more resources than they do. But we're just not telling people about it. So I'm a big advocate of really, you know, boosting our marketing efforts. I think in Washington, obviously the Supreme Court is huge. No matter how you feel about, you know, our current president, he's made very specific promises to the pro-life community to only appoint pro-life Supreme Court justices. We've got to hold him to that. We've got to hold him to his promise to defund Planned Parenthood, because we need to stop funding our biggest opponent. And, you know, this is the abortion Goliath. So we have a lot of work to do.
Boy, we do. But that was a magnificent summary of what needs to be done. Kristen Hawkins, president of Students for Life, where can people find out more about you and the work that you do there at Students for Life?
You can go to studentsforlife.org or go to facebook.com/studentsforlife.
And thank you so much for being with us today on Catholic Answers Focus.
Thank you for having me.
And God bless you in your work.
Thank you.
And listeners, thanks so much for joining us today on Catholic Answers Focus. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and you get to meet the most interesting, fascinating people on Catholic Answers Focus. So keep looking for us here each Friday afternoon on Catholic Answers Focus. We'll see you again next week.